That's key. I think spoke to that public hearing, but this is one of the more important aspects of the bill. In addition to the criteria, so far as actual day-to-day administration of the hearings on evidentiary matters, Representative Bellamy. At least that was one spoken to. Do we have any amendments that have tried to deal with this section in any way?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that we have, no.
Does this committee, I'm going to try and step through it one by one. Does any committee member have any interest in changing this part of the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I have to say that it is that if we do not deal with the expanding the criteria, and in my opinion, I'm going to have to have a lot of convincing that there's anything left in this bill, because in my opinion, we're still not going to be able to get to the people who we're dealing with. I mean, we can expand all the criteria we want, but if we cannot use it for those people that need the help, then what are we doing it for?
Representative Bellamy, I think one of the points comes forward in the privilege area, and I don't know whether you had an opportunity to attend one of the commitment hearings, but when you try and deal with the population that we're speaking of, there's some pretty sharp lawyers in the system that know the evidence and privilege code pretty well that use it to defend their client, as well they should in a system that's adversarial. Sections 1 and 2 deal with the doctor privilege and will allow, well, they deal particularly with records and will allow in commitment proceedings some more evidence in to that proceeding. Perhaps the ultimate effect of that would be to commit those people, more of those people that need to be committed within the system. If you're looking for bits and parts as to what effect other parts of this bill will have, I give you that as an example. I've been one of those defense lawyers from time to time in those proceedings.
All right, we have a major bill here. We have a lot of amendments. And my opinion is that all we're dealing with is that individual, for the most part, that is already in the system. The real frustration is eventually getting the system. All this is going to do is give a little better access to the individual that has already committed the crimes and has already been hospitalized. I mean, they already have to do all of these very awful things before they can ever even begin to start. And in my opinion, all this does is finally give access, a little better access to those things, once the individual is absolutely, totally done everything possible to stay out of the system. And that's my point. I think we're basically addressing the very few cases that the real interest level is out there. But those people are already in. They've already committed the crimes. The only way we can get them help. They've already been hospitalized, but most of these people will tell you that's after they've finally gotten there, they're beginning to get help. There's a whole lot of people out there that we can't get them any help because they haven't gotten into the system.
Representative Bellamy, there is no requirement at present, under the present criteria, that a crime be committed before a person be committed.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, but I will tell you that effectively for most of these people, until they commit a crime, we have no way to help them. You can tell me it isn't legal, but I'll tell you it is effectively the way it is.
Well, in my direct experience in these systems, the people that have gone through the commitment proceedings, at least in my experience, at least half the cases that I've been directly involved in, there was no crime committed.
But if those people do not want to receive help, then there's no way that you can even get them into the system. If they object to help, then the only way you effectively get them into the system is to finally commit a crime.
No, that's not correct.
Well, we have a difference, but I...
Well, I guess we have a difference.
That's where my difference comes in saying that if we don't deal with the expanded criteria, I don't see any need in the bill.
Be that as it may, Representative Bellamy, and I understand your position, it's my intent to move through the bill and to deal with putting it in as good a shape as possible. So, Council, Sections
3, I believe.
Section 3. Uh-huh. The Indigent Defense Court.
Okay. If we could deal with Sections 3 and 4 at the same time. This basically deals with the Indigent Defense Board. And once again, it's something that we have discussed before and which Mr. Bray has discussed before. What this these two sections would do would require the State Indigent Defense Administrator to pay for the costs of examining an individual rather than the county. We have amendments before us that, for the reasons stated by Dr. Bray, would amend this section to keep the current law in place.
The current law in place is that the county pays for the examiner.
That's correct.
And those amendments are... Let me ask it this way. Let's just take it in concept.
Mm-hmm.
The chair would move in concept that we adopt Dr. Bray's recommendation to take the expense out of for examiners out of the Indigent Defense Board mm-hmm. and return it to counties. Is there objection?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do we have a handle on the impact of the Indigent Defense Board if they took on the cost?
I've forgotten whether or not we did have a fiscal on that.
I talked with the fiscal analysis analyst today. They are still working on this measure and waiting to see what happens on many of our amendments because they have such a potential for fiscal impact.
Answer is no, Representative Miller.
Given the state of the Indigent Defense Board, you're not looking to further shackle their operation, I think.
That would be a fair summary of my position. The Indigent Defense Board has enough of its own problems without adding to them an additional fiscal responsibility. However, I would intend to be as consistent as possible throughout this bill where we're dealing with this in trying not to shackle counties with new state costs. And doing a reverse of this too, but at the same time trying to set some policies. Further questions?
Just if the information's coming, I guess at some point before we finally address it, that would be helpful. And I suspect we might hear as to how receptive the counties are to the idea.
We would be changing nothing in regard to counties if we adapted this. We're just taking it. Leaving it where it is.
Unless they see the opportunity to send it on and are
right.
And attracted to that notion.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection to adopting in concept that amendment to remove the cost of examiners from the Indigent Defense Board? Hearing none, that is adopted. Counsel?
I just want to raise one other thing. I see here also that we're not, in addition to the cost of examiners, we're also talking on line 29 of page 4, paying the cost of witnesses. And I understand that witnesses are paid for by, I guess, Bingsley, you mentioned to me they're paid for. Who pays for witnesses? I'm trying to read your note here. The state?
Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator's Office. The state pays for witnesses called on behalf of indigent, allegedly mentally ill persons. However, the reason it's even in the bill to straighten it out is the statutes are unclear in Chapter 426. We just follow the division that's followed in all other types of cases, criminal and juvenile. That is clarified in the statutes. And what the purpose of adding it to this was just to clarify the saying that prosecution pays costs of calling their witnesses and the defense pays for the cost of defense witness and state pays when they're indigent. Is that responsive? Thank you.
That would remain so.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Sections beyond section 4, what's the next cognizant, easily describable part of the bill that we can address?
Well, we have section 5, which is the next section. That's the expanded criteria.
Yeah, and we'll skip that. And let me just repeat. Section 5 is not something that we wish to address today. We will discuss section 5 further, I'm sure, outside of this committee. And if there is language that we can deal with in this committee, we will try to deal with it. Council, Section 6,
Mr. Chairman. This is the section that deals with jurisdiction for commitments. Making a clarification, I believe that it would be with a circuit court judge.
Mm-hmm. What are we addressing in Section 6? If I recall, some of the parts of this bill, and it's been shuffled around and redrafted, but some of the parts don't reflect any changes. They're just perhaps a more artful drafting by legislative counsel.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Many of these changes are really trying to bring this whole area in the law under one particular section or sections, rather than having it scattered throughout the Oregon Code.
Section 6, then, yeah, no substantive change?
My notes show me that there's no substantial substantive change.
Okay.
Question. As I understand, apparently, in some counties, the circuit court judge doesn't necessarily participate. This language would say only circuit court would be allowed to participate. Is there any impact? I don't recall whether anybody complained about that or what the practical effect of it is.
I don't think, not to my recollection, Representative Miller.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 7.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Section 7 deals with the commitment proceedings. If I can just find up my bill here. And it basically is a recodification of current law with some additions. I see that some of the changes that have been made here, where you see the language is being moved to other sections. But as I said, it simply talks about the procedures that one follows in and the court follows in a commitment proceedings. It talks about in the bottom of page 5 who may initiate the commitment proceedings. There's no change there. I think on the top of page 6 it simply sets forth the procedure that you follow. It must be in writing under oath. If I remember correctly, there was some discussion about the words under oath. It said basically the commitment procedure.
Is there objection to moving forward? Section 8 is technical and no substantive change, according to the notes from Dr. Bray or from Mr. Murray.
That's correct. It basically, if you look at it, it's only 2 lines and talks about what's being added.
Next, we have a couple of new sections. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we might not have the entire committee here or more than 40% of it, if they're listening, so that we can continue on what's an important bill with new sections.
Section 9, counsel.
Section 9, as Mr. Bray's analysis has mentioned, is treatment and pre-commitment holdings. It talks about how they are being treated prior to hearing and establishes certain requirements.
Now, if I recall, one of the emphasis that was behind this was to treat the different kinds of holds uniformly.
That's correct.
Is this the section that we're referring to?
I believe it may be one of the sections.
Uh-huh. And one of the intents was to make that a uniform treatment.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection to Section 9? Done. Let's move on to 10, and that relates to the investigation.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. As you said, it relates to investigation, and it's at the timeline of which investigation should be completed. And I believe that the furthest point it would be within 15 days from the date of community mail file, the director designee receives a notice. Then some of the following shall occur. The investigation shall be completed and submitted to the court. That's part of it. An application for extension shall be made to the court, et cetera. It's all set forth in the bill between lines 27 and 37 on page 8. As I said, and as you said, it basically sets forth a timeline in which an investigation must be completed.
What do you have fiscal impact on this section?
No, we don't, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, let me restate my question. The new investigation procedures, Representative Miller, go ahead.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Well, the new investigation procedures will... the theory behind the bill was to expand the abilities of investigation, and I imagine it would cost some more money within the system. Is that in the governor's budget, Dr. Bray? Yeah. And these are the sections that speak to the expanded investigation. Yes, we are getting an affirmative nod from Dr. Bray. And, yes, Representative Miller.
Briefly return to Section 9, the holding situations. I don't know whether this the language in here about the positions or whoever... and others who are involved in the hold must make sure the person receives care, custody, treatment required for mental and physical health and safety, and all methods of treatment shall be the responsibility of the treating physician, and the person shall receive usual and customary treatment in accordance with medical standards in the community. Does this add any new burdens that also could add cost, or is that, are we asking for any different or higher standards that would require additional financial assistance, or?
Mr. Chairman, let me respond. If we look back on page 7, lines 27 through 34, my notes show me that all Section 6 has been moved to Section 9. So that Section 9, I believe, is a lot of it is current law.
Representative Miller, I think that shows some of the problems of trying to rearrange a statute when you're going through the process of trying to amend the statute. You don't know which part's been amended versus which part's new because of the way we draft these things.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are some differences.
Go ahead, Randy.
At least in the section with, like, persons shall not be subject to the electroshock therapy or unduly hazardous or unusual treatment procedures.
Uh-huh.
That is carried over into new Section 9. However, it continues that the person... they aren't going to receive that, but they are going to receive the usual and customary treatment in accordance with medical standards in the community. And I just wonder if that indeed constitutes a new
feature that may have an additional cost burden.
I'm sure, Representative Miller, that my reading of that language is that that everyone, if they're going to receive medical treatment, is entitled to and shall receive usual and customary treatment in accordance with medical standards in the community. I mean, the answer, I think, is no.
No additional burden.
I would think not.
Can I ask you a practical question?
Sure.
Sure.
Dr. Bray, why don't you come up and sit at witness stand?
Question dealing with the standard, Mr. Chairman, is the standard based on both private care and public care, or is it measured against other public treatment facilities, or what is the community standard? What determines the community standard?
Well, I think Representative Miller.
All.
Medical standards in the community may differ, may change from time to time as to whether or not there's a difference between private medical standard and public medical standard. I would certainly hope not.
You might hope not, but if you were in a facility that was somehow was financed well versus maybe some more sparse facility financed by public monies, maybe the standard of treatment would be somewhat less due to fewer personnel. Maybe Dr. Bray knows.
Many of these holding facilities, most are in hospitals, in local general hospitals. And we have a standard that we survey those hospitals and certify those holding rooms as being safe for people who are dangerous to themselves and others and held in the hospital.
Okay.
And then what this provides is that while being held there, those people would have the standard medical treatment that they would get, that anybody else in the hospital would get.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Randy, do you have objections on
no.
Sections? Okay. Where are we at? Section 9.
Well, you did 10, and then I jumped you back to 9, I think. So. Where you
right.
addressed 10.
Right. Okay.
Chairman, this is a new section from the notes that I have from Mr. Bray here. This section, once again, as we said before, establishes a timeline in which an investigation must be completed once started. It also expands the scope of investigation. And in addition, you do not need to have the consent of a mentally ill person to talk to his relatives. I believe under the current statutory law and case law that you have to have the mentally ill person's consent, which I think puts the mental health profession in somewhat of a catch-22.
Dr. Bray, this section on expanded investigation and the ability to interview parties without the consent that the investigator has probable cause to believe have pertinent information. Would it be fair to describe this section and other sections that deal with not expanded criteria but expanded investigatory abilities and expanded resources towards a targeted population? Representative Bellamy's objection was, without the expanded criteria, there's nothing left in the bill. Do you agree with that or not?
No, I wouldn't. This is a good example of a part of the bill that allows the investigator to get more information so that more information would be presented at the time of the hearing. And it also provides for the warning to be given to the person so that it's clear that they will be talking with some other people.
And the Section 10 is provided for in the governor's bill.
our governor's budget?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Objections to 10. Any amendments that we have in here that deal with 10? I don't think so.
No.
Mr. Taylor?
No. Mr. Chairman, I know of no amendments that are dealing with this section.
Okay, let's move on to 11.
Mr. Chairman,
if you would.
Section 11 is a new section, and it relates to the warning that must be given to a mentally ill person or a person who's before the court on the grounds that he may be mentally ill. It not only says that the gives a warning, but if the warning is not given, the warning itself does not constitute grounds for exclusion of evidence that would be otherwise admissible in proceedings. At least it's my opinion that what that says is that you would not be able to let in evidence that would say testimony obtained from someone to which you gave a warning. But if you could introduce other evidence independent of that testimony, then you could do so to prove that person was mentally ill.
Is there objection to 11? Are there fiscal impacts that are not provided for?
No.
Okay, then we'll move on. Section 12. Yes, Representative Miller, on 11.
I had to just do it again, but just 10, just since you're noting concerns and so forth.
Okay.
Committee, I'm still kind of concerned about the Section 10. We've got so many B's and D's here. Sub 2, sub B. On the, if the mentally ill person objects, then merely it's just noted on the record. I understand the problem, but I need to spend some time with whether or not that's okay in my mind. It doesn't seem like much protection if we're trying to afford any here. And like you just say, well, I don't want you to do it. And those who want to do it say, okay, well, we'll note that on the record and proceed.
Well, the reason for having that on the record is the record ultimately will be at the hearing, and the person will be represented by counsel under those circumstances. And if there is a legal point to be made that an objection was made and yet the contact was continued with that other person, that will be documented and available for cross-examination. That's the reason for putting it in the record. Counsel, where were we at? We're on 12.
I believe so, Mr. Chairman. At 12 is a cleanup provision, and it relates to pre-hearing procedures.
Payment of witnesses.
Right, correct. I'm going to read it.
How is this a change, Dr. Bray, or is it just a clarification?
The need to subpoena the treating physician as an expert witness comes about by the fact that the clinical record for the hold period is entered into the court. This was one of the amendments I discussed that does have a fiscal impact, and the intent of the task force was that by and large, under the new approach, the investigator will come to the hospital at the time of the hold and will have access to that record, as will the examiner, and they would become the expert witnesses. So one of the amendments we've proposed would change this section so that the there wouldn't be a cost here for the treating physician. But that's the reason for the treating physician.
we're speaking to the section as it exists. What does the section do? You don't want the expert witnesses to appear. Am I correct?
That's right. There are two reasons: the cost, and also getting the people out of the doctors out of the hospitals and into the court. Would be preferable if they were staying in the hospitals. If we can have somebody else come and carry that information to the court. What this section does is. Basically saying that you can subpoena them and provides, as it's now written, for payment of them. So that's not the amendment, but the way it is now.
The amendment would do what?
The amendment would take out the part about paying them.
But still require them to come?
They could be subpoenaed. It was the intent of the task force that the examiner and the investigator, because they could read the record,